So we're taking up in November the 24th, 1922. Okay. There are two very interesting things here. And Louise is going to be talking about Jesus before Herod. And she's going to look at the effects of the word of Jesus and of the gaze of Jesus. Both of those things. Okay. I was thinking of when my sweet Jesus was presented to Herod, and I said to myself, how is it possible that Jesus, who is so good, did not deign to say a word to him or to give him even, we would say, a glance? Who knows whether that perfidious heart would have converted at the power of his gaze? And Jesus, making himself seen, told me, my daughter, his perversity and the lack of disposition of his soul. Look at that. That's very important. Everything is according to the dispositions of the soul. So a person could go to Mass and receive communion, and if they haven't got the right dispositions, they might not benefit at all. Okay? Yes. The lack of disposition of his soul were such that he did not deserve that I look at him or even say a word. I think that's about the worst judgment that Jesus could make of anybody, that the person didn't deserve either a look or a word. If I had done it, he would have made himself guiltier, because each word or each gaze of mine are additional bonds which are formed between me and the creature. Each word is one more union, one more closeness. And as the soul feels looked upon, grace begins its crafting. If the gaze or word was sweet and benign, she says, how beautiful, penetrating, gentle and melodious it was. How is it not possible to love him? If then it was a majestic gaze or word, blazing with light, she says, what majesty, what greatness, what penetrating light. Now, these comments have been Louise's comments all along to Jesus' approach to her. How small I feel, how miserable I am, how much darkness in me before that light so blazing. You see, we don't see the darkness in ourselves without his light. That's Psalm 36, verse 9. Psalm 36, 9, in your light we see light. If I wanted to tell you the power, the grace and the good which my word or gaze brings, how many books would you not have to write? Isn't that amazing? Mm-hmm. Now, for the power of his word, you have the whole of Psalm 119, the longest psalm in the book, hundreds of verses. You also have Psalm 19. Psalm 19 says that God has given us two books, and verses 1 to 6 is the book of the heavens, and verse 7 to 14 is the scriptures. Okay. Now, apropos of last Saturday, I want you to put a heading over the next paragraph. Disciples have to become teachers and masters. Okay, that's precisely the school you're in. This is a very, very important message. See then how many goods I have done to you in looking at you many times, in keeping you with me in intimate conversations. And they've not just been words, but complete discourses. That's for Louisa. But this you can understand, from this you can understand that the unions between you and me, the relations, the bonds, the closeness are innumerable. I acted with you like a teacher who says only a few words to the others who want some direction from him, but spends the entire day with his own disciples, wanting to make of them as many teachers similar to himself. So if he's letting you get detailed teaching, then you have to become a teacher yourself. He speaks at length. He's always over them. And first he develops one topic and then he gives them a simile to make himself better understood. Full stop. He never leaves them alone for fear that getting distracted they might waste his efforts. And if needed, he subtracts hours from his own rest in order to instruct them. He spares nothing. neither efforts nor strains nor sweat in order to obtain the intent that his disciples become masters. That's extremely important. You need to colour it. In other words, the Lord doesn't give us this teaching just for our own benefit. He gives us this teaching so that we ourselves will reach out and will teach others as well. Okay, so that's the very reason for the school of spirituality you're actually involved in. Okay, so if you want to put a heading for the next paragraph is you've got to proclaim to others. Okay, you've got to proclaim to others. But before I give you the proclaim to others, I want to give you Luke 11, 16 to 18 at the end of the last paragraph. Luke 11, 16 to 18 and 2 Corinthians 4, 5. So Jesus said, "This is the way I behaved towards you. I spared nothing. With others I had just words, but with you discourses, long teachings, similes, at night, during the day, at all times. How many graces have I not given to you? How much love to the point of not being able to be without you? It's because of the great design that I have upon you." Everybody take note. "This is why I gave you so much. You then, in all gratitude, would want to keep what I have told you and keep them hidden inside of yourself and deny me the glory that I would receive in manifesting it." You can't do that. That's what he's saying. You can't just keep this to yourself. If we keep the teaching of the divine will to ourselves, we are doing the Lord an enormous disservice, because there are people out there who will never hear about it unless we tell them. Okay. He said, "If you keep it hidden within yourself, you would deny me the glory that I would receive in manifesting it. What would you say of that disciple who, after his teacher had reached the point of making him a master through many toils, would want to keep for himself the education that he had received without imparting it to others? Would he not be ungrateful and a cause of grief to his teacher? What would you say of the sun if, after I gave it so much light and heat, that it would want to let this light and heat not let it descend upon the earth?" I mean, the very reason why the light and heat is given to the sun is that it will give it to the earth. So the logic here is that the very reason why this material is given to you is not just that you yourself grow, but that you will pass it on to others. So this is a very, very important text. We have to become teachers. Would you not say to the sun, "It's true that you make a good impression, but it's not good that you keep it to yourself"? So beside that, I want you to put Matthew 28:20, where Jesus says, "Go into the whole world and proclaim the gospel to every creature and baptize whole nations, not just individuals." So it's not good that you keep it to yourself. The earth, the plants, the generations await your light and your heat. How much more do the generations of God's children await the light that we have for them? They want them in order to receive them and the fertility that comes from them. Why do you want to deprive of us of such a great good? More so, since in giving them to us, you lose nothing yourself. This is the extremely important thing, that in passing this material on to other people, you lose nothing. In fact, you gain. You acquire more glory and everyone will bless you. Okay, he said, that's the way it is with you. So I want to give you Matthew 5:14. Let your light shine so that others may see and give glory to God. You are even more than the sun. I have placed in you so much light of truth about my will that more than the sun, it would be enough to illuminate everybody and to do more good than the sun itself does to the earth. I myself and the generations, you need to write that follow because it's understood. The generations that follow await this light to be unleashed from you, while you think of how to hide it, and you almost afflict yourself if authoritative people want to occupy themselves with putting it out. No, no, he said it's not good. So I want to give you 1 Corinthians 9:16. and Romans 15:19. So here we've, it's a wonderful point to finish volume 14 with. He says, share it with others, spread the light. I would hate the Lord to say to me in death, you didn't tell anybody else. You didn't share it with somebody else. You didn't give life to anybody else. I wouldn't be able to take that because I would consider that a complete failure as a disciple. So I think this message that finishes volume 14 is one of the high points in this whole message. So Louisa said, I felt I was dying in hearing my sweet Jesus, and I felt even guiltier because during those days, since one of my writings had been withdrawn without achieving the purpose for which it was released, that is to put it out, I felt great satisfaction. Oh, how bad I felt in being reproached so severely. Interesting. And wholeheartedly, I asked his forgiveness, and Jesus, to calm me down, blessed me, telling me, I forgive you and I bless you, but you don't do it again. That's called being ticked off, good and proper. Okay. So why would he give this message if he didn't want the whole world to hear it? Okay. And the only people who can tell the whole world is the people who have heard it. So here you can see that we're involved in a mission. It's not just a devotion. It's not just a spirituality. It's actually a mission. Okay. So at the beginning of volume 15... the first message is that the divine word is seed, okay, and then he'll talk about the divine will is seed, and then he will say that the divine will is the crown of creation, and then he will say the tree of the divine will. So he's using images that are very powerful in the scriptures, the seed and the tree. Okay. Now, the heading for the first reading we have here, which is November the 28th, 1922, is that the divine will is the beginning, the means, and the end of every virtue. There's no holiness without it. So, Louisa said, I was praying, fusing all of myself in the most holy will of God, and with some doubts in my mind concerning all that my sweet Jesus keeps telling me about his holy will. And he, clasping me to himself with a light, that's your Psalm 36, verse 9 again, that's infused knowledge, which he cast into my mind, he told me, my daughter, my will is the beginning, means, and end of every virtue. Now, without the seed of my will, and you know the seed is the thing that produces the plant, isn't that right? Without the seed of my will, it cannot be given the name of true virtue. It is like the seed for the plant. After it has sunk its roots into the grounds, the deeper they are, the higher the tree becomes, which the seed contains. So first there is the seed. This forms the roots. The roots have the strength to make the plant sprout from under the earth. And as the roots sink into it, the branches are formed, which keep growing so high as to form a beautiful crown. And this will form the glory of the tree, which, unloading abundant fruits, will form the usefulness and the glory of the one who actually sowed the seed. Okay, so we're talking about the highest spirituality there is. And he says, if it's not all based in the divine will, as the seed is the source of the plant, forget about it. You're not in divine will. The divine will has got to be actually the source of everything. And so he tells us in the next paragraph that this is the image of his church. The seed is my will, in which the church was born and raised. But in order for the tree to grow, it takes time. Now, remember Luke 8:11, it's the mustard seed. And Matthew 13:31, it's the seed becoming the tree. It takes time. And in order for some trees to give fruit, it takes a length of centuries. This is actually a very important illustration, if we just stop for a moment. And that is, while it takes some plants just a few months or a year to produce their fruits. In other cases, Jesus says it takes a length of centuries. But he's not actually talking about plants, he's talking about us. And therefore, we have to have enormous understanding and patience with each other and with ourselves, because you don't produce the fruits of divine will overnight. And for some people, it can be very, very, very slow. It might be 7 or 8 years later that I call the penny drops as to what it's all about. Other people can get it almost the first time you tell them. It was just that souls are very, very different to each other, but we've got to have enormous patience. And the fact that a person may be slow in responding doesn't mean they won't produce the fruit. This is what the Lord is telling us here, which I think is very important. Now watch this. The more precious the plant is, the longer it takes. Now you wouldn't have thought that was the conclusion, did you? You would have thought the conclusion was some of us are a bit slow and we just don't get the message. And Jesus says it's the exact opposite, that if a plant is very precious, it's actually very slow to produce, which I think is very interesting. It's the same with the tree of my will, which is the most precious and the most noble and divine, the highest. And therefore, it took time for it to grow. That's the 2000 years from the foundation of the church until the revelation to Louisa, for its fruits to be made known. And so the church has known the seed, because all the saints have done the will of God, haven't they? And there's no sanctity without it. Then she has known the branches. Or remember John 15, I am the vine and you are my branches, okay? But it's always the same tree that she is around. Now, now that's in the present time, she must know the fruits in order to nourish herself and enjoy them. Okay. And Matthew 7:25 says, you will recognize her by the fruits. So now is the time, the 21st century, that she will know the fruits of this long, long growth of the church. And this will be all my glory and my crown, as well as all the virtues of the entire church, because the entire church is that vine. In every single generation, it's all just one thing. And Jesus tells us that the saints in heaven, the militant church on earth, and the suffering church in purgatory are all one. We're not separated. We're not many kingdoms. So for the rest of this, he talks about knowledge of the divine will and the importance it is to inquire in knowledge. Now, we've just had a message saying that you must become from disciples, you must become teachers. Well, to become teachers, you have to have the knowledge, hence the study. And that's why it's so important for us to continuously study the texts. Now, what is the wonder if instead of manifesting the fruits of my will? Now, the fruits are Galatians 5:20, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, and so on. Galatians 5:20. If instead of manifesting the fruits of my will, before I have manifested them to you, after so many centuries, okay. If the tree was not yet formed, how could I have made the fruits known? So you can't produce the fruits before the tree has actually developed. All things go like this. So he's talking about this divine order in everything. And there's a divine order in our growth as well. And certain things have got to happen within us before other things can be manifested, because there won't be the right environment for them. So the Lord is very ordered in the way he does things. All things go like this. If someone is to be made king, the king is not crowned before the kingdom, the army and the ministers and the royal palace are formed. He's crowned at the very end. And if anyone wanted to crown the king without forming the kingdom, the army, etc., he'd only be a king of mockery. Now, my will was to be the crown of everything and the fulfillment of my glory on the part of human creatures, because only in my will can she say, I have accomplished everything. That's consummatum est. Okay, I've accomplished everything. John 19:30. John 19:30, and Psalm 22:25-30. That's the Old Testament version of Consummatum Est. And finding in her accomplished everything I want, not only do I make her know the fruits, but I nourish her and I make her reach such a height of holiness understood, because a height means a height of holiness, as to surpass everyone. And this height of holiness is that the divine will is the highest level of spirituality. This is why I love so much, and I so much care that the fruits, the effects, and the immense good contained in my will, and the great good which the soul receives from it, be known. And it can't be known unless somebody is teaching it, somebody is revealing it, somebody's explaining it. Now, none of us can explain it at the level that the Lord would like it explained, but we have to do what we can. If they're not known, how can they be desired? You see, if it doesn't get out that the divine will is the most incredible thing that God has offered to us, nobody's going to want it. Much less can anyone be nourished by them. And if I did not make known the living in my will, what it means, the values it contains, the crown would be missing to creation and to virtues, and my work would be a work without a crown. He's talking about a completion. It wouldn't be a completed work. This then, see then how necessary it is that everything I have told you about my will be manifested and made known. Now he's going to repeat this message many times as we go on. And also the reason why I push you so much, and how I always make you go outside the order of others. Now, outside the order of others is that the priests who are guiding Louisa only know about the ordinary spirituality that's been in the church for 2,000 years. They can't push her forward. They can't push her on. Jesus alone can push her on. And so he brings her, long before volume 15, he has brought her to a place where the others can only learn by listening to her, because she's in a completely different space than any other saint. Okay. So she's way beyond the experience of anybody else. And if these, as well as the graces given to them, I make known after their death, in your case instead, I allow that what I have told you be made known while you're still living. The urgency of that is that with other saints, their writings are only published after their death, like Faustina, for example. But that's all right, because it was within the normal Christianity parameters. OK, and so anyone with goodwill can understand it, as you know, if you read her stuff. But since Louise, what was being revealed to Louise, it was outside of what anybody knew. The whole thing had to be organized while she was still alive. And that is because whatever they didn't know, she could ask Jesus and get it clarified. Jesus alone could clarify the problems that the church could have. So you can see why he absolutely insisted on the priests being involved from the very beginning, so that they could ask all the questions. And you'll find from here on in, some of the questions that Louisa asked are definitely not her own. I don't think from the Louisa that we've got to know that some of the questions that are asked are from herself. And it'll be nice if we can guess when they're not her questions. It'll be good for you, because then you'll be hearing the dialogue that's going on between the church and the Lord. What are you telling us? Where is this going? What are the, and so on. So that's why it has to be done while Louisa is still living. If it's not known, it will not be appreciated nor loved, which is absolutely true. Knowledge will be like manure for the tree, which will make the fruits mature. And once they are well matured, the human beings will nourish themselves from them. In other words, when the divine will mission is well established and the basic knowledge of it is known, people can reach out that they actually wanted. And that's happened in Ireland, that more and more people are wanting to actually join the divine will. So he said, what will be my contentment and yours? So December the 1st, 1922, this is volume 15. Jesus did and suffered everything in the divine will. That's the important piece here. And then what true reigning means. You see, there's a thing in the world outside where they think that if you're the head of a government or you're a king or you're an emperor, that that's reigning. Jesus will say, absolutely no. We've had far too many examples down in history that people who had no control over themselves were trying to dominate others. Think of King Herod. We've just been reading about him. A man who had absolutely no control over himself, becoming a tyrant to try and control others. Okay. So Louisa said, I was thinking about the passion of my sweet Jesus, and I felt those pains so close to me as if he were suffering them at that very moment. This is the level of her union with Jesus, that when she's contemplating it, she can actually feel it. And looking at me, he told me, my daughter, I suffered all pains in my will. Now, he has already explained before, and he will continue to explain, that if he didn't do this in the divine will, his passion would not be able to redeem everybody. He would be limited to a human thing. But in the divine will, then it becomes unlimited and it redeems everybody. I suffered all pains in my will. And as I suffered them, they, that is the pains, opened many paths, we would say. My book says ways, paths, in my will to reach each soul. Now I'm putting soul there instead of creature. Had I not suffered in my will, which envelops everything, my pains would not have reached you 20 centuries later. Can you see what he's saying? And everybody else, that's past, present and future. They would have remained within my own humanity. Even more, because I suffered them in my will, not only did they open many paths in order to reach souls, but they opened as many other paths in order to let them enter into me, unite themselves with those pains. See, I'm slightly trying to turn this into English. Is that all right? Mm-hmm. And to give me, each one of them, the pains which, with their offences, they would give me throughout the course of all centuries. Now, beside that, I want you to put Exodus 17:6. Exodus 17:6 is that moment in the Exodus when Moses was told to strike the rock. You remember? Mm-hmm. And that water would come from the rock. And the text says, the Lord says, I will stand before the rock. And you're told that Moses hesitated. Why? Because he realized to reach the rock, he had to strike the Lord. Okay. And the rock represents the rock of our salvation, and the water, the waters, the grace of salvation. And that's precisely what happened on the cross, that the Lord himself, the rock of our salvation, was struck and the living waters of grace came from him. Okay. And these living waters have flowed for 21 centuries already. So you need to put Ezekiel 36. No, is it 36? 37 is the dry bones. I think it might be 36. The water flowing from the right-hand side of the temple. Do you remember it? And it flows out into the Arabah and it becomes a great river. It's 36, I think. And that's what he's saying here. So let me just read it again. This is a long sentence. Because I suffered the pains in my will, and not only did they open many paths in order to reach souls, but they opened as many other paths in order to let them enter into me, unite themselves with those pains and give me each one of them, that's each one of us as well, the pains which, with their offences, they would give me throughout the course of all centuries. That's striking the rock and the water flowing from the rock. And while I was under the storm of blows, that's the scourging, my will brought me each soul to strike me. That's why I wanted to give you that thing about striking the rock. And that's why we have, my comment at the side is simply a very modern statement, me too. I struck him as well. Okay, I'm just using the language that the Me Too crowd are using. That's why when we read the Passion narrative in Holy Week, that the congregation has got to shout, crucify him. Yeah. They have to, yeah. Because that is in fact our position, that every soul needed him to die for us. And he explains that, Louise explains that well in the Hours of the Passion. So each soul had to strike me. So it was not just the ones who scourged me, but the souls from all times would concur in my barbarous scourging with their offences. Now, he admits that it was barbarous. The same with all the other pains. My will brought me everyone. So Jesus is making it perfectly plain that we were all there in the Passion, every one of us. And I think it's when we realise more and more deeply that we were in fact there and that he was paying for my individual sins as distinct from anybody else's. That's what makes the impression. We begin to sort of wake up, you know, because some of the people who have become saints just by realising he died for me as well, including Saul of Tarsus. He died for me. You know, that makes all the difference. My will brought me everyone. No one was absent from the roll call. Everyone was present to me. No one escaped me. This is why my pains were, oh, so much harder, how much more numerous than that which could be seen. So I want to give you Isaiah 53 there. They scourged him until he looked no longer human. And Louisa describes him like a skinned lamb, which of course he was. Therefore, if you want your offerings of my pains, your compassion and reparation, your little pains, not only to reach me, but to follow the same paths as mine, let everything enter into my will. In other words, if you don't do them in the divine will, they're not really much use. And all generations will receive their effects. Isn't that wonderful? Okay. And this not only with my pains, but also with my words, because being spoken in my will, they reached everyone. In the end of volume 5 of Maria Valtorta, where she's dealing with the final teachings of Jesus before the ascension, one of the things that the apostles say to him, and I think it's wonderful, they say, but we don't remember anything you said. You know, it was all kind of a big lump in there. Now, many people feel that way about Louisa's writings as well, that we've gone through all these volumes and it's all a big clump in there. But Jesus said, actually, it's not a clump in your soul. It's just that your mind can't pick out individual details. And he said, if you want the details to come out, then you ask the Holy Spirit and he pulls out exactly what you need. So that's like opening a drawer and there's all kinds of stuff in it. How am I going to find what I'm looking for? And he said, you just get the guidance to pull out the bit that you want. That's very important when you're teaching and helping others. Okay. So it not only with my pains, but also with my words, because being spoken in my will, they reached everyone. And as, for example, before I go on, I want to give you Jeremiah 31 to 34. They'll all be taught by God. So as we're reading and studying and meditating these texts, it's actually the Lord that's teaching us. Nobody else can. Okay, so when Pilate asked me whether I was a king or not, that's John 18:36. I answered, my kingdom is not of this world. Poor Pilate, he wouldn't have a clue what he was saying. For if it were of this world, millions of legions of angels would defend me. Now, poor Pilate didn't know what an angel was, you know. And Pilate, seeing me so poor, humiliated and despised, was surprised, and he said, "What? You are a king?" And I, with firmness, answered him, "And all those who are in his position." What position is he in? Leading the world in terrible ignorance. Haven't we got leaders leading us in terrible ignorance? Mm-hmm. "I am king, and I have come into the world to teach the truth. And the truth is that it's not positions." Watch this now. "It's not positions. It's not kingdoms. It's not dignities, nor the right to command that makes man reign, that ennoble him, that raise him above all. On the contrary, these things are slaveries and miseries, which make him serve vile passions, and unjust men make him also commit many unjust acts, which disennoble him, cast him into the mud, and draw the hatred of his subordinates upon him." Wow. So, riches are slaveries. Positions are swords, by which many are killed, that is spiritually as well as physically, and wounded. True reigning is virtue. Okay, I want to give you Proverbs 10:25 there. True reigning is virtue. To be stripped of everything, which of course Pilate wouldn't have understood, to sacrifice oneself for all, to submit oneself to all. This is true reigning, which binds all, that means all souls, past, present and future, and makes one loved by everyone. I want to give you Romans 5:17, where he says, we reign with Christ. Okay. "Therefore, my kingdom will have no end, and yours is nearer to perishing." So I want to give you Psalm 145, verse 13. Psalm 145, verse 13. I want to give you Isaiah 9, verses 6 to 7. It must be John 4, 3. I'm not completely sure. Sometimes I can't read my own writing. And Jesus says, "And in my will, I made these words reach the ear of all those who are in positions of authority." Look at the power of the divine will. That even though they won't read the scriptures, even though they won't listen to the church, they won't listen to anybody, the power of the divine will is in each one of them. And so their consciences will tell them what the Lord has said and let them know the great danger they are in. And to put on guard those who aspire to positions, dignities and command. Isn't that very clear? Mm-hmm. I think it's wonderful. And what Louisa is telling us is that, you know, when we read that little bit about Jesus standing in front of Pilate, we only read the meagre conversation. We don't see what's behind it, or that Jesus is trying to reach everybody who is reigning upon the earth. I find that fascinating. So December the 2nd, 1922, Jesus places three pillars in the soul of Louisa. Okay, that's very interesting. "I was feeling very afflicted because of the privation of my adorable Jesus. And if he makes himself seen at all, he's all taciturn," which of course means there's chastisement going on. "Then this morning he made himself seen in my interior between two pillars." Now, we do talk about pillars of the church. And he's talking about pillars because in the ancient world, when they raised up these big buildings, they were all the roof of the building literally was resting on pillars. And whenever there was disasters or earthquakes or anything, the only thing that seemed to survive are the pillars. And you have that all over the Middle East. You have these pillars still standing. Okay, so the pillars are important. And we do have the expression, the pillars of the church, don't we? He was forming a third one between these two, and he could lean on one and then on the other. So I want to give you something for pillars. Psalm 75, verse 3. and Galatians 2:9. Now, you might be surprised at Galatians 2:9, but in Galatians 2:9, Paul refers to Peter and the apostles as those pillars. And he wasn't complimenting them either. So Jesus wanted to lean on one pillar and then on the other, and also on the pillar in the middle. I didn't want to tell you who the pillars were because it'll spoil the text, which he was raising. Surprised, I said to him, my love and my life, when have you put these pillars in my interior? Now you are more comfortable, so if you are tired, you can lean on them. And he, without listening to me, continued to raise the pillar and kept silent. So Louisa kept talking. You're supposed to keep quiet if he's quiet, you know. But tell me, why don't you talk to me? She's Italian, you know, and you have to talk. What is the matter? Where have I offended you? Is it perhaps my reluctance in making known the truths that you tell me that makes you keep silent in order to punish me? Now, Louisa persists in that opinion. Now, we're in volume 15. She has persisted for 15 volumes. He has told her endlessly that when he doesn't come to her, it has nothing to do with any fault on her part. He's told her time out of number, and she still persists. You've never stuck to your own opinion that much, have you? And the thing that is really important to me is considering the place she's in her relationship with God, that she could still stick to her opinion. Forgive yourself, won't you? Yeah, because we can find it very difficult to let go of something that you're convinced about. You can find it very difficult. So you tell me, she said, you tell me that makes you keep silent. Oh, yeah. You tell me it should be what makes you keep silent in order to punish me. But I promised you that I would not do it anymore. And remember, we remained in peace. Now, no wonder Jesus isn't answering, because this is nonsense, isn't it? Okay. And Jesus, looking at me and heaving a strong sigh, told me, my daughter, I'm working, I'm enlarging, I'm preparing. And when I work, I don't feel like talking. Do you mind? First, I want to operate and then I speak. In other words, will you wait and give me a chance? It's like you're giving a talk and people want to ask questions before you've told them the message. So they're not listening at all. To your reluctances, he said, I pay no heed, because the power of my will that acts in you is so great that it crushes you if you do not want what I want. Okay. Now, I want to give you a few texts for that. John 4:34. This is Jesus submitting to the divine will. John 5:17. John 6:28. John 9:4. John 17:4. And you can just put etc. because it's a summary of the John's Gospel. And also Romans 8:28. Okay. Now, because she is actually living in the divine will, Jesus has control, because it's his will that's actually ruling. Okay, so he says, look, I can actually crush you if I want to. So much so that after a reluctance of yours, you're forced to run into my arms to tell me, Jesus, I pray you to make me do what you want. You want it, I want it. And you do not let me go unless you see that your will and mine are one. Therefore, my silence is work, so that the work I'm doing in you may be more beautiful, more secure, and more stable. Now, the Lord can't afford to tell us what he's doing inside of us, because human beings interfere with everything. You know that, don't you? Now, we say we don't, and we say we cooperate, but we do in fact interfere, because we are afraid to not be in control. It's one of the problems of an adult. Okay, so the Lord has to work away quietly inside of you and not actually tell you what he's doing. Have you ever sat down quietly to reflect over the last 6 months and you realise you've changed in the last 6 months, but you didn't notice it on any particular day because the Lord had to do it quietly, sort of behind your back, in a kind of a hiding mode. So he said, everything has to be more stable. So in order to do that, I put it between two pillars, stronger and higher. One of these pillars is my humanity, and the other one is my mother. So he's telling us there's two pillars we have to lean on. Otherwise, we won't make the journey. Okay. And he said, on which only I can lean. But two supports are not enough for me. I need a third one. In other words, the rest of us need Louisa as well. But if I do not form it for myself, how can I have it? So Jesus himself has to form the third pillar. Louisa can't do it. She doesn't even know about it. So here is the necessity for my work. You will lend me the materials, that is, you give me your will and your consent, which are all your acts done in my will. And the more you do, the more materials you will lend me, and I will work hard in forming it, and then I will rest and speak to you. Okay. So you've heard a number of things about the value of acts in the divine will, and now you see that he is building a structure inside of you with these acts. Okay. Everything I did and that which my mother did will be connected together in this third pillar. My only purpose, that it may be worked with an eternal will, which alone can serve as my support, and that this will may be known. Look at the emphasis again. I will put so much grace into it that it will not only give me rest, but it will serve me as a pulpit. That's a place where you proclaim, okay? It will serve me as a voice to teach in the most attractive, penetrating and convincing manners what it means to live in my will, that I may no longer be in the midst of my children like an exiled one. So he's building up the divine will in Louisa. So he's calling it a pillar. And from this pillar, he's going to be able to teach the rest of us. Okay, and reveal what he wants for the rest of us. But my will, so I won't any longer be like an exiled will, but my will may reign in them on its own throne. In other words, that the rest of us will begin to live in the divine will as well. Therefore, let me do. Okay, so he's telling us here that our souls are the throne of the divine will on earth, and it's the way Jesus returns to the earth to rule the earth. So afterwards he came back again, and he continued to make himself seen in my interior, all intent on working, and we would look at each other in silence. I raised my eyes and I saw the head of our Lord placed on the top of one pillar and that of the celestial queen on top of another, both crowned. In other words, this is their triumph, to reign like this in a soul. The third pillar which he was forming was prepared for my head to be put on its top. And the crown that was to crown it came out half from the crown of our Lord and half from the crown of the Blessed Virgin. In other words, nothing from us. We're nothingness. And uniting together, these two halves formed one single crown. I remained amazed and enchanted, and my sweet Jesus told me, my daughter, have you seen how much I have to work in order to form for myself the third support, and how you must hasten to form the materials? In other words, give me more acts. I need more materials. You must hasten to form the materials so as to let me work, and what height it must reach. That's the summit of holiness, okay? In order to accomplish the work of my will in you, and what crown must surround your forehead. Therefore, do not lose a minute of time, but let your flight in my will be continuous. So I want to give you Revelation 2:10. Revelation 2:10. 1 Peter 5:4. 1 Peter 5:4. And James 1:12. That's the crown on your forehead, okay? So December the 8th, Louisa is meditating on the Immaculate Conception. I write to obey, she said, and I offer everything to my sweet Jesus, uniting myself to the sacrifice of his obedience. Now, isn't that lovely? That she has to do an obedience that's difficult for her, so she unites herself to difficult obediences that he had. This is just the clue we need, that whatever we're doing needs to be united to something specific in his life in order to obtain the grace and the strength to do what he wants. And now, oh, my Jesus, give me your holy hand and the light of your intelligence to write together with me. Okay. I was thinking about the great portent of the Immaculate Conception of my Queen and Celestial Mother, and in my interior I heard him say, my daughter, the Immaculate Conception of my beloved Mother was prodigious and all marvellous, so much so that heaven and earth were astonished and made feast. All three divine persons competed among themselves. The Father poured out an immense sea of power, and I, the Son, poured out an immense sea, infinite sea of wisdom, and the Holy Spirit, an immense sea of eternal love. Okay, so there's three titles for the Blessed Trinity: power, wisdom, and love. Okay. And when you fuse in the divine will, you can say to the Lord, I take your power, wisdom and love so that I can pray at your own level. So they all merged into form one single sea because it's three in one. And in the middle of this sea, the conception of the Virgin was formed. Isn't that fantastic? So that's Luke 1, 48 to 49. She was chosen among the chosen. We would say creme de la creme. So the divinity administered the substance of this conception, and this sea was not only the center of life of its of this admirable and singular creature, but it remained around her not only to keep her defended from anything which might shadow her, but to give to her at every instant new beauties, new graces, new power, new wisdom, new love, new privileges, etc. Because Jesus keeps on saying that for someone living in the divine will, the outpouring of the divinity to that person is continuous. Okay. So her little nature was conceived in the center of this sea and was formed and grew under the influence of these divine waves, so much so that as soon as this noble and singular creature was formed, the divinity did not want to wait, as it usually does with other creatures. It wanted her embraces and the return of her love, her kisses, and to enjoy her innocent smiles. Therefore, as soon as her conception was formed, notice the I. Jesus has been talking in the third person about the Blessed Trinity, and then he says I, because he is the Lord. I gave her the use of reason, the first instant of conception. I mean, as they say, this is off the Richter scale. I endowed her with all knowledge. I made her aware of our joys and our sorrows with regard to creation. Even from the maternal womb, she would come to heaven at the foot of our throne to give us her embraces and the return of her love or her tender kisses. And throwing herself into our arms, she would smile at us with such delight of gratitude and thanksgiving. Now, the thing that's missing from the rest of us is the gratitude and thanksgiving. Which such delight of gratitude and thanksgiving as to snatch our smiles. Oh, how beautiful it was to see this innocent and privileged creature enriched with all the divine qualities. Wow. Coming into our midst, all love, all trust, without fear. Because perfect love, of course, casts out fear. And perfect love casting out fear is 1 John 4. And it's verses 7 to 17. I usually only give you verse 7. In fact, sin alone is what puts distance between the creator and the creature, breaking love, dissolving trust, and striking fear. That's Isaiah 59, verse 2. And Jeremiah 5, 25. Isaiah 59, 2 and Jeremiah 5, 25. So she would come into our midst as queen, who with her love given by us would dominate us, enrapture us and put us in feast and capture yet more love. Now everything she had came from them, because we have nothing of ourselves. And so she's giving back God to God his own love, his own grace, his own gratitude, everything, which is exactly what we're called to in the divine will. And he said, we would let her do it, enjoying the love that enraptured us and constituting her queen of heaven and earth. Now, this was what God's intention was for the whole human race if the fall hadn't happened. So we would have been as much at home in heaven as on earth. That's amazing. Heaven and earth exulted and made feast together with us, having their queen after so many centuries. That's Romans 8:19, that all of creation groans looking for these children of God. Romans 8:19. The sun smiled with its light and considered itself fortunate in having to serve its queen by giving her light. The heavens, the stars and the whole universe smiled with joy and made feast because they were to delight their queen, showing her the harmony of the spheres and of their beauty. The plants smiled, which were to nourish their queen, and the earth too smiled and felt ennobled in having to provide the residence for its empress to be trodden by her steps. Only hell cried. That's fantastic, isn't it? And felt itself losing strength because of the dominion of this sovereign lady. Now notice the difference that one makes. One is a majority in the kingdom of God. And you see, we people on earth seem to think that you can get nowhere unless you have 100,000 signatures, you know, because that's earthly power and that's totally limited. But in spiritual terms, one person is enough. And very often to turn the tide of a whole era, the Lord will use one person. He used one Elijah, for example. He only needed one Mother Teresa of Calcutta. He only needed one Faustina. He only needed one Louisa. That one person truly given to him can turn the tide completely. So the next paragraph is Act 1. And the paragraph after that is Act 2, different stages. But do you know what was the first act which this celestial creature did when she found herself before our throne for the first time? Now, don't forget now, she's only a few cells. And they say nowadays that that is nothing. And here she is, she's going to make reparation for the whole earth. See how utterly wrong we are? Okay. She recognized that all the evil of man had been the split between his will and that of his creator. Okay. She trembled, and with no delay, she bound her will to the foot of my throne without even wanting to know her will. And my will bound itself to her and constituted itself the center of her life, so much so that all currents, all relations, all communications opened between her and us for the first time since the fall, that heaven and earth were open to each other. So the all currents, all relations and all communications. Beside that, I want you to put John 1:51. It's the ladder. Remember? The ladder of communication between heaven and earth. And there was no secret that we did not entrust to her. Okay. So you have Amos 3:7, that the Lord always tells his prophets before he does anything. You have Isaiah 64:10. He will always tell his secrets to the people who are close to him. So since the Blessed Mother was conceived at the highest level of sanctity, therefore there is no secret that was not given to her. This indeed was the most beautiful, the greatest and the most heroic act that she did, the very first one, which was to lay down her will and never serve her own will. And he tells us that whenever we get to the stage of being able to finally lay down our will to him, that there's nothing else he will ask, because that's the most heroic thing you can possibly do. Now, she did it at the very beginning. Can you imagine how difficult it must have been for her, knowing all of this, living in Nazareth, knowing everything, to keep her mouth shut and say nothing? It's when you look at some of the instances in the gospel with this knowledge in the background that some of her reactions are fascinating. One of her reactions is given in Maria Valtorta, where Judas insisted on staying with her for a few days and did terrible damage to Jesus while he was staying under her roof. And her comment to Jesus was, "That man frightens me." What an absolutely measured comment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she just said, "That man frightens me."
And she pondered everything.
Absolutely everything, yeah. Yeah. "But that man frightens me." She could read him. Yeah. She knew exactly what he was doing. She knew the damage he was doing to Jesus and everything, you know. So it's just that this level of knowledge and understanding is also a huge burden. Mm-hmm. We have the privilege of not knowing what's going on in people's heads, do you know what I mean? And not knowing what's going on out there. And so you can have some measure of peace. But if you know everything that's going on, it's a ferocious burden. So laying down her own will was the most heroic act that she did. An act which made us as though enraptured and constituted her queen of all. Do you see then what it means to bind oneself to my will and to not know one's own? To not know means to not let your own will be your servant. So if we get to that point before we die, we'll be doing well, you know, because we have a much longer journey to take. Of course, we think we've done it, you know, and then you discover that you haven't even remembered the divine will for the last couple of hours. Do you know what I mean? Oh, because we're way back. And I mean, we're talking about people who are up in the stratosphere as far as I'm concerned. So the second act, I just call it act two, was that she offered herself for any sacrifice for love of us. Isn't that something else?
Yeah.
The third act, that's act three, was to render us the honour and glory of the whole of creation, which man had taken away from us by doing his own will. And even from the maternal womb, she cried for love of us. Isn't that incredible? On seeing us offended, and she cried with sorrow over guilty man. Oh, how these innocent tears moved us and hastened the longed for redemption. Because in Maria Valtorta, the Lord actually does say that because of her, redemption was brought forward. Yeah. This queen dominated us, bound us, and snatched infinite graces from us, because God is love. And to get this incredible sacrificial love from such a tiny creature would absolutely touch him. She made us incline so much towards mankind that we could not resist, nor did we know how to resist her repeated petitions. But whence came to her so much power and so much influence over the very divinity? Ah, you've understood. It was the power of our will acting in her. It's the fact that the same divine will that operated in the Blessed Trinity was operating in this little creature. So it's the same divine will, which while dominating her, rendered her the dominator of God himself. Okay. This is the love God and do what you like of St. Augustine, which is vastly misunderstood. And besides, how could we resist so innocent a creature? Matthew 18:10. Possessed by the power and the sanctity of our will. It would be as though resisting ourselves. We could see our divine qualities in her. We could see the reflections of our sanctity, the reflections of the divine ways, of our love, of our power, etc., poured over her like waves, as well as our will, which was her centre, drawing all the reflections of our divine qualities and making itself crown and defence of the divinity dwelling within her. If this Immaculate Virgin had not had the divine will as the centre of her life, all the other prerogatives and privileges with which we so enriched her would have been, in comparison, an absolute nothing. So the greatest gift which the Lord is offering to us as well is the divine will. This is what confirmed and preserved her so many privileges. Even more, it multiplied new ones at every instant. Because that's the beatitude of heaven, that the blessings and the glory is multiplied at every single instant. Okay. So in the next paragraph, he's going to tell us that the divine will remained intact in the Blessed Virgin. Here then is the reason why we constituted her queen of all. Because when we operate, we do it with reason, wisdom, and justice. She never gave life to her own human will, but our will was always intact in her. So that's where she's different to all the rest of us, including Louisa, because Louisa had to enter into the divine will later in life. Okay. And Louisa had to be released from the original sin and concupiscence. All the elements, the heavens, the sun, the earth, would have withdrawn from the power and dominion of this creature. All would have cried out in their mute language, "We do not want her, we are superior to her, because we've never withdrawn from your divine volition." So the thing that was extremely important was to have somebody who had never, ever gone out of the divine will. So the whole of creation could have said, "As you created us, so are we." So would the sun have cried out of with its light, the stars with their glittering, the sea with its waves and everything else. On the contrary, as soon as they all felt the dominion of this excelling virgin, isn't that wonderful language? Who almost as their sister never wanted to know her own will, but only that of God. Not only did they make feast, but they felt honoured to have their queen, and they ran around her to form her cortege and to pay obsequies to her. The moon, by placing itself as a footstool under her feet, that's Revelation 12:1. The stars as her crown, still Revelation 12:1. And the sun as a diadem, the angels as servants, and men as though in waiting. Okay, so the image of Revelation, Jesus is completely confirming here. Okay, everyone paid her honor and rendered their obsequies to her. There is no honor and glory which cannot be given to our will. Whether acting within us, in its own centre, or dwelling in the creature. Okay. I want to give you 1 Samuel 2:20. Those who honour me, I will honour, says the Lord. 1 Samuel 2:20. But do you know what was the first act which this noble queen did when, coming out of the maternal womb, she opened her eyes to the light of this low world? Now, as we go into the higher volumes, earth is called the low world. Okay. As she was born, the angels sang lullabies to the celestial baby, and she remained enraptured. Her beautiful soul went out of her little body, accompanied by angelic cohorts. Now, this was her first ascension into heaven, okay? And went around the heaven and the earth, gathering all the love that God had spread throughout the whole of creation. And penetrating into heaven, she came to the foot of our throne, offered us the return of the love of all creation, and pronounced her first thank you in the name of all. Now, this is the second time that thanksgiving has been underlined, because the human race is identified as ungrateful. Okay. Oh, how happy we felt in hearing the thank you of this baby queen. And we confirmed in her all graces. Now, some saints at the last minute of their lives, if I can put it that way, were confirmed in grace. I say the last minute so that they couldn't sin. Do you know what I mean? They're confirmed. And it was considered by the church the highest gift that God would ever give to anybody, that the person would be confirmed in grace. Louisa has long since been confirmed in grace, long before you got to volume 14. And here we're told that the Blessed Virgin is confirmed in grace and she's only barely born. Okay. We confirmed in her all graces, all gifts, such as to make her surpass all other creatures together. So there you have her Magnificat, all generations will call me blessed. Okay. Then throwing herself into our arms, she delighted with us, swimming in the sea of all contentments, being embellished with new beauty, new light, and with new love. She pleaded once again for mankind. Now you're told this is the second time that she pleaded for the human race, praying us in tears to let the eternal word descend in order to save her brothers. Now, this is incredible because it's immediately after birth. Okay. Can you see that the modern apostasy that has thrown our Blessed Mother out? They're missing everything. That's really sad. So here, she's only barely born when she's interceding for the second person to descend and become incarnate. But as she was doing this, our will let her know that she should descend to the earth. And immediately she left our contentments and joys and departed in order to do what? To obey. Yeah. Okay. So to obey, I want to give you John 20:18. Mary of Magdala got up from the feet of the Lord where she wanted to stay forever and she obeyed him. Okay. What a powerful magnet our will was dwelling on the earth in this newborn queen. No longer did the earth appear alien to us. Matthew 1:24. Matthew 2:14 and 15. So this makes you understand the Star of Bethlehem then, doesn't it? That God wanted to make everybody find this child. We no longer felt, Mary's child when the child was born. We no longer felt like striking the earth, making use of our justice. We had the power of our will, which in this innocent child blocked our arms, smiled at us from the earth and turned justice into graces and sweet smiles. So much so that unable to resist this sweet enchantment, the internal word hastened his course. That's twice tonight you've heard that he came ahead of time. O prodigy of the divine will, to you everything is due. Through you everything is accomplished. We need to really take that on board. Everything is accomplished through the divine will. And there's no greater prodigy than my will dwelling in a soul. Isn't that fantastic? There's no greater prodigy than the divine will dwelling in a soul. We haven't met for a while, so I'm going to do another one, which is the conception of the eternal word. This is a wonderful piece as well. These pieces are ones that all you can do is meditate on them and let the Lord open it up to you. Louisa said, I was thinking about the act in which the eternal word descended from heaven and was conceived in the womb of the Immaculate Queen. That's John 1:14. And from within my interior, my beloved Jesus put out an arm surrounding my neck and in my interior told me, my beloved daughter, if the conception of the Celestial Mother was prodigious and she was conceived in the sea, which came out of the three divine persons, my conception was not in the sea that came out of us, but in the great sea which resided within us, our very divinity. So this is a divine conception, okay, which descended into the virginal womb of this virgin, and I was conceived. It's true that it is said that the Word was conceived, but my celestial Father and the Holy Spirit were inseparable from me. I think that's terribly important as you're reading the whole Gospel, and most particularly when you're reading, when you're looking at Jesus on the cross. The Father and I are one. That's John 10, 29 and 38. John 10, 29 and 38. The Father and I are one. The three divine persons cannot be separated. It's true that I had the acting role, that is, that he was the one who became incarnate, but they were concurring because you cannot separate the three persons in God. It's a great mystery that we can't deal with. Imagine two reflectors, each one reflecting the same subject to the other. These subjects are three. The one in the middle takes on the operating, that's the second person, suffering, supplicating role, and the other two are with it, concur with it, and are spectators as well. So I could say that one of the two reflectors was the Most Holy Trinity, and the other was my dear mother. During the brief course of her life, by living always in my will, in her virginal womb, she prepared for me the little divine ground. You need to underline divine, because she was doing everything in the divine will, in which I, the eternal Word, was to clothe myself with human flesh, since I would never have descended into a human ground. Why could he not descend into human ground? Because it was unworthy and filthy. Okay. So if the Blessed Mother had not been prepared the way she was, he couldn't have descended. Because nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. She had to be the Ark of the Covenant, isn't that right? So just put A-R-K there, and then you've got lots of references in the Old Testament that you have in the book of Exodus anyway. So she becomes the Ark of the Covenant, and the Ark of the Covenant went before the people. So a Blessed Mother's life had to go before the whole church. Okay, she's also the tabernacle in the Exodus as well, holding the divine presence. Okay, and as the Trinity was reflected in her, I was conceived. So while that same Trinity remained in heaven, I was conceived in the womb of the noble queen. All other things, as great, noble, sublime, and prodigious as they may be, all remain behind, even the very conception of the Virgin Queen. There's not one thing, neither love, nor greatness, nor power, which can compare to my conception. Here, it is not about forming a life, but about enclosing the life which gives life to all. It's not about expanding, but about shrinking myself so that I might be conceived. That's Philippians 2, verses 6 to 11. And I also want to give you John 1, 4. John 5:26, John 8:12, and John 11:25. So it's about shrinking myself so that I might be conceived, and not in order to receive, but to give. The one who created everything. That's Psalm 104:30. the one who created everything, Psalm 104:30, Psalm 148, verse 5. Isaiah 41:20, 42:5, and you have to add etc. because it's all over Isaiah. Okay, the one who created everything. Enclosing himself within a created and tiny little humanity. These are works only of God. Knock out the A, because that's a wrong translation. And of a God who loves. Okay. It's above all about love. John 15:9. 1 John 2:15. 1 John 3:1. And 1 John 4:7 and 16. Because you'll notice we're getting here a summary of John's gospel and John's writings. Okay. The one who created everything, enclosing himself within a created and tiny little humanity. These are works of God, and a God who loves and who at any cost wants to bind the creature with his love in order to be loved. So the whole thing is about love. And the whole summary of the 36 volumes is love and divine will, because it's all about the same person. But this is nothing yet. Do you know where all my love, all the power and the wisdom blazed forth? Now, love is the Holy Spirit, power is the Father, and wisdom is the Son. As soon as the divine power formed this tiny little humanity, so little as to be comparable to the size of a hazelnut, isn't that interesting? With which all the members proportioned and formed, and the word was conceived in it. So I want to give you Psalm 2:7. Jeremiah 1:5. Isaiah 49:1 and Galatians 1:15. We're getting such a summary of the scriptures here, it's unbelievable. The word was conceived in it. The immensity of my will, enclosing all creatures past, present and future, conceived all the lives of creatures in it. Jeremiah 31:3, I've loved you with an everlasting love. So in his conception, he conceived all creatures in himself. And as my humanity grew, so did they grow within me. So even though I appeared to be alone, when observed under the microscope of my will, all creatures conceived in me could be seen. It happened with me as when one sees crystal clear waters. Even though they appear to be clear when observed under a microscope, how many microbes cannot be seen? The interesting thing is that doesn't refer to Jesus' time because they didn't know what a microscope was. It refers to Louise's time when microscopes are in use, which is very interesting. And it's true, I think, one of the great joys of teaching chemistry and biology to children, which I've done, is to take a little amount of water and put it under a microscope and let them see how much life is in there. Mm. And the fascination that they have when they actually see that the water is living. I say, this is living water. And they say, no, it's just water. And I say, no, I'm going to show it to you that it's living, and just put a drop of it under the microscope. They're totally fascinated. Mm. And then they want to see the rest of it. And I said, this water is completely full of life and it doesn't look as if it is. Yeah, it's fascinating. So Jesus is saying, I look as if I'm alone, but if you really could penetrate the reality that was there, all creatures were conceived in me. My conception was such and so great that the wheel of eternity... Now, that's going to be talked about more as we go on. Remained stunned and ecstatic in seeing the innumerable excesses of my love. There's your Christmas novena, okay? Mm-hmm. And all the prodigies united together. The whole mass of the universe was shaken in seeing the one who gives life to everything shrink, reduce himself, enclose everything in order to do what? To take the lives of all and to make them all be reborn. Okay. So Philippians 2, again, verses 6 to 11. John 1, 14. And you've John 3, 5. We all have to be born again, don't we? We all have to be reborn in him. Now, that's a massive thing. It actually requires an enormous amount of time, more than we can actually give it. But you hear why the church says through him, with him and in him, everything, absolutely everything. If you go into Colossians and Ephesians, everything was made through him and for him. And he's the head. He's absolutely everything. So this here, what we've just read, is such a summary of John and Ephesians and Colossians that I'm not going there. I'm going to ask you to go there and just read them in the light of this. And you'll be fascinated. You'll be amazed. Okay, because what you're getting is a summary. So we'll stop there.